This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight...
The UN Refugee Agency says a new potential refugee crisis may be developing as hundreds of Togolese refugees flee political instability and escalating violence.
That's Lisa Schlein reporting from Geneva. Full details coming up also. Kenya's Electoral Commission has called for patience and calm as its ally tallies the results of yesterday's rerun presidential election. And the city of Ambo in Ethiopia's Oromia region is quiet a day after a clash between protesters and security forces left 11 people dead. We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, Kenya's Electoral Commission has called for patience and calm as it tallies the results of yesterday's rerun election. Presidential election. However, some already fear that the low turnout, just 35% compared to nearly 80% in the previous poll in August, may undercut the credibility of the results. From Nairobi, VOA's Jill Craig has more.
The chief of Kenya's Electoral Commission says 6.5 million voters, about one-third of all registered voters, cast ballots in the election Thursday. Opposition leader Raila Odinga told his supporters to boycott the vote, and some polling stations looked like ghost towns. Others had lines, but significantly shorter than the original August election. Some were closed entirely due to security concerns. Murithi Mutiga is the International Crisis Group's Kenya analyst.
If this turns out to be the final act in what has been a very dramatic election, it will be a very unsatisfactory conclusion for all sides. Certainly for the president, he will move forward with what seems like a very shaky mandate without a clear mandate from the people. That's a very, very low turnout. It's the lowest turnout in Kenya's multi-party history. We've had six elections since 1992, and the lowest was just about 57%. In general, Kenyan election turnout levels are always above 65%.
The Electoral Commission said voting would take place Saturday in four areas of western Kenya where polling was halted due to violent clashes between protesters and security forces. But late on Friday, the commission said electoral staff would be at risk and postpone the voting to an undetermined future date. As of mid-afternoon Friday, the IEBC reported that it had received the large majority of official polling station forms and official constituency forms back from the field, but had yet to announce any vote count. President Uhuru Kenyatta is making his second attempt at re-election. The Supreme Court nullified his victory in the August 8th poll, ruling that the Electoral Commission had not followed electoral law into the Constitution. Odinga called for several members of the commission to step down and for the polls to be postponed beyond a 60-day deadline announced by the court. The opposition has not said whether it plans to file a legal challenge against the results of Thursday's election. Odinga told supporters he would give further instructions on Monday. Jill Craig, VOA News, Nairobi.
Political and religious leaders in western Kenya warn that plans to reattempt polling in four counties will further inflame tensions. The Electoral Commission had to postpone voting in those areas yesterday due to security concerns and an opposition boycott. Late today, the Electoral Commission postponed the voting again, citing threats to electoral staff. No new date has been announced. Mohammed Yusuf reports from Kisumu.
Western Kenya is a stronghold of opposition leader Raila Odinga. Residents say they plan to respect Odinga's call to boycott the polls. Resident Joshua Ochieng says, "I'm not going to vote and I will make sure no one goes to vote. Because every time we vote, our victory is stolen. This should be the last time our victory is stolen." Violent unrest prevented polling stations from opening in the city of Kisumu Thursday. Youths blocked roads and clashed with security forces. Hospital officials tell VOA three people were killed by gunshot wounds and more than 50 were injured. There were more protests in some parts of Western Kenya Friday. Local media report that one person was shot dead in Bungoma County. Church leaders in Kisumu gave a press conference Friday, saying they feared more bloodshed if election officials try to proceed with polling. Bishop David Kodaya of the Anglican Church of Kenya Bondo Diocese.
We want to say categorically as church leaders, we don't condone violence and will never condone it in any other way. But every individual, every single human being has a right to self-defense. And a time may come when our people will have to defend themselves in whichever way possible.
Kisumu County Governor Anyang Nyong'o said people cannot be forced to take part in the election.
The assumption is really made that if these people have said that they're not going to vote, then the next step that the government should take is bring force here to force them to vote or to force them not to prevent others not to vote. Now, that's a tall order. I'd rather you persuade them not to do that than create maximum force to force them. You just alienate people further.
Kisumu was mostly quiet Friday, with many streets clear to traffic and some shops open for business. But late in the day, VOA saw youth burning tires and blocking some roads in the city. They told VOA they were trying to block the delivery of ballot papers. Mohammed Yusuf for VOA News, Kisumu, Kenya.
The UN Refugee Agency says a new potential refugee crisis may be developing as hundreds of Togolese refugees flee political instability and escalating violence. Lisa Schlein reports from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
The UN Refugee Agency says more than 500 Togolese have recently arrived in Ghana seeking asylum. UNHCR spokesman Baba Baloche says they are fleeing political unrest in their country.
Togolese seeking safety, including women and children, told UNHCR staff earlier this month that they had fled on foot, walking from their homes in Togo's Mengo region, bordering Ghana. They said they were fleeing human rights abuses after the recent political protests.
At least 10 people have been killed in anti-government protests in Togo since August. Opponents are calling on President Faure Gnassingbé to step down and for a return to the 1992 constitution, which imposes term limits. The president took power in 2005 and can continue to run until 2030 under current law. The opposition considers that unacceptable and is demanding electoral reform. Balash tells VOA the UNHCR hopes the situation is resolved soon and that the agency does not end up having to deal with another refugee crisis in Africa.
Togo's neighboring countries are quite worried that if the situation is not resolved soon, maybe more people would flee. That's why they have approached the UN Refugee Agency to prepare themselves for any further refugee arrivals.
Balar says nearly 30 asylum seekers reportedly have arrived recently in northern Benin. He says it is not clear whether that is related to the current unstable situation in Togo. He says so far there are no reports of asylum seekers arriving in Burkina Faso. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
14 past the hour, you were listening to African News Tonight on The Voice of America. The city of Ambo in Ethiopia's Oromoya region is quiet a day after a clash between protesters and security forces left 11 people dead. The town's head of communications, Gadisa Dasaleng, told VOA's Horn of Africa service that 15 people also were injured in protests yesterday. He said most of the victims were university students, although one 13-year-old child was killed. The latest protest was triggered by shortages of sugar. The Salein said federal and special elite Agassi forces who deployed to the area early yesterday were responsible for the deaths. VOA's Horn of Africa service contacted the Ethiopian government for comment, but so far has not received a reply. Last year, government development plans, which opponents said amounted to a land grab, sparked months of protests in Oromoya. Nearly 700 people were killed in one bout of unrest last year. The UN-sponsored dialogue to restart the negotiations for a political solution in Libya faces new challenges. The House of Representatives, which is aligned with the commander of the Libyan National Army, General Khalifa Haftar, suspended participation in the dialogue. The House members want a written position from the rival High Council of State before continuing talks. And some militias that General Haftar supports have attacked neighborhoods in the suburbs of Tripoli. Isander El Amrani is the North Africa Project Director of the International Crisis Group. He told VOA's Mohamed El Shenawi that the talks are not yet completely derailed.
Right now, that seems more like a temporary setback. I believe the UN negotiating team is trying to address some of these issues, and indeed the House of Representatives delegation has offered a solution, which is that the State Council make its position clear. So it would derail it only if they now decide not to come back, but that's not clear at the moment.
But local media close to General Haftar say the general has a plan for conquering Tripoli without firing a single shot. Would that mean he is still resorting to force himself from a position of absolute power?
Well, I think the plan that is being alluded to is that General Haftar would convince various militias in the West to switch sides, and so he would be able to take control of the capital without firing a single shot. Some worry that this may be possible. General Haftar has been able to secure the support of local groups before in other parts of the country, in the south and in the Gulf of Sirte area, for instance, in the last year. However, Tripoli is a bit different in that it has strong militias that are well-armed, that are backed by the UN-recognized government, including some that would be extremely unlikely to cut a deal with General Haftar against that government, simply because they are on complete ideological opposites.
So what should the U.S. do to discourage this temptation of taking Tripoli by force and at the same time support the U.N. strategy for Libya?
Well, I mean, the official position of the U.S. Has been to support the U.N. and to condemn any attempt to change the balance of power by force. So it already has the same approach officially, but I think the problem now is more that the U.S. is relatively disengaged from the Libyan issue under the current administration. Apart from fighting ISIS, there isn't really much of a U.S.-Libya policy at the moment, just nominal support for the U.N. process. And I think it's important to send General Haftar the message that he cannot just try and change the reality on the ground as part of the negotiations. If he's serious about negotiations, then he has to allow the delegations that represent the government he's loyal to do their job. That message isn't always clear, whether it's by the U.S. or by others, and not just for General Haftar's side, but also for the other side. And I think it's important for a major power like the U.S. to persuade Libyans directly, but also those who support the various camps, and on General Haftar's side, I'm thinking especially of Egypt and the United Arab Emirates, to play more of a role to put pressure on General Haftar to stop resorting to incendiary rhetoric and threats to take the capital.
That was Isander El Amrani, North Africa Project Director of the International Crisis Group. He spoke to VOA's Mohamed El Shenawi. Egypt's state news agency MENA says security forces have killed 12 armed militants in the country's western desert. No police were killed in the incident today. MENA reported that an anonymous security source said security forces dealt a severe blow to the terrorist elements in revenge for the blood of the men who were martyred last week. The shootout happened about 175 kilometers southwest of Cairo, near the location of last week's deadly attack on police. Authorities say at least 30 Egyptian policemen were killed last week in a western desert shootout with militants about 135 kilometers southwest of Cairo. In Zimbabwe, a return to growing small grains is one idea being considered to fight climate change and boost food production. Reporter Kudzai Zanawashi takes a look at the idea and at other sustainable farming measures.
Majority of farmers deny climate change and have continued to plant crops like maize that need plenty of water to survive drought. But agricultural engineer Herbert Madzamba says recent weather events are changing their thinking.
Prolonged heat waves like we're experiencing in Harare now. The seasons have shifted. We no longer receive our rains late October. Now they come probably mid-November in some areas, which never used to be the case. We also have the flash flooding. These are all realities which happen year in, year out. Some people contest because they do not appreciate what agriculture is all about.
Madzamba works with seed companies and village women to implement better farming practices that includes biofortified seeds. He says many farmers are looking for harder and more robust foods, many which were used decades ago before maize became popular. Among them are cereal crops such as sorghum, millet and rapoko, a small grain sometimes called finger millet.
Because they require less water, they require less nutrition, so you can grow them in any of the drier regions. They would survive with about 400 millimeters of rain. By so doing, they become an alternative.
Nelson Mudzingwa is a farmer and the national coordinator for the Zimbabwe Smallholder Organic Farmers Forum, which includes over 18,000 farmers. He explains his group's support for reviving these traditional foods.
That is one of the areas that we have been emphasizing quite a lot. We have four regional clusters. The central and the western, these are the most dry areas. In these areas, the small grains, they are only way of food production, and the small grains in particular, the cereals, the sorghum, the pearl millet and the rapoko.
The Zimbabwe Smallholder Organic Farmers Forum encourages its members to adopt the farming practices dating back Zimbabwe's pre-colonial era before maize was introduced. Madzamba says that includes the use of new once used crops.
They don't yield more than maize. They yield less, but they can survive with less inputs and less rainfall. The small grains are more nutritious because even before maize came, those were consumed by our forefathers. The reason why we are now biofortifying maize is out of the realization that maize delivers less nutrition than the small grains, but we cannot harvest as much of small grains compared to maize.
The grains could be used to make the popular thick porridge called sadza, which is usually made from maize powder. But lack of research on the crops has resulted in the failure to develop machinery to plant, harvest, and process them at a large scale. The nutrition-rich crops have also gained a stigma because they are recommended for those with HIV and other illnesses, thus making marketing harder. Observers say a public enlightenment campaign may be needed to convince consumers and farmers to give the forgotten foods a try. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zanawashi from Harare.
Many African countries are facing pressure to feed growing populations. At the same time, they are experiencing extreme weather conditions like drought and unusually heavy rains and flooding. One U.S. agency working with African partners to cope with the challenge is USAID, which is helping to implement the U.S. government's Feed the Future initiative. It works in a dozen countries around the world, including Ethiopia, Ghana, Kenya, Mali, Niger, Nigeria, Senegal, and Uganda. The administrator of USAID, Ambassador Mark Green, recently traveled to East Africa to assess the progress of his agency's efforts. He talked to reporter Peter Clotey about USAID's work to meet farmers' short and long-term needs in Ethiopia.
We have a program called Feed the Future, which I think is a great innovation. I'm a big supporter, big believer in it. And that helps us on the resilience side. So on one hand, there's the immediate need, and we will be there working with host country partners to provide food and water if we can to meet with immediate needs. But again, what we want to do is to apply these technologies and these tools to help people help themselves going forward. So it's a combination of those immediate needs, basic nutrition, because we all know that in a child's life, those first months are so crucial to that child's future intellectual development. We'll always be there for that, but then also working with them to take on those longer-term challenges. Nobody can predict exactly when disaster will strike, but we can take steps to protect ourselves and strengthen ourselves against the impact and the effects.
So far, how have these people reacted to some of these programs and measures that you've talked to them about?
They've embraced them. I'll give you an example of Ethiopia, where I was. I was at a food distribution, and I remember we had just provided some grain to a woman who was going to take it and divide it up for her family, and she asked me if she could ask a question. I said, sure. And her question was the perfect question. And the question was, can you help me with irrigation so I never have to do this again? I thought, that's the question. There's a woman who's trying desperately to provide for her own family, looking for help, not looking for handouts. She doesn't want to take grain. She'll take grain because her family's hungry, but what she wants to do is lead herself and her family and her community, and so embrace it. I saw a microfinance facility in the Somali region in Ethiopia in which we were helping particularly women who have a difficult time getting credit to help them do their small businesses. I saw it doing so well that a traditional bank across the road, as I was at the microfinance facility, they were all staring down. They were not happy, because everybody was doing the microfinance, a lot of it SMS-based, cell phone-based. I also saw a program that was helping farmers provide fodder for cattle, sort of counter-cycle so that they're protected when the drought occurs. And then finally, I went to a wonderful facility. It was a slaughterhouse. In the slaughterhouse, they were bringing in high-quality carcasses to be able to dress down and then provide to Middle East, selling to the Middle East. So taking that wonderful resource they have in Ethiopia, wonderful pastoral lifestyles, and they produce very high quality meat, serving a market that provides them with real capital and hard capital that they can use for the future. So what we've seen is that people embrace these tools. Again, you know, the Africans that I know are like everyone else. They want to lead themselves. They don't want a hand out. They're looking for a hand up. We can help them with these tools.
That was the administrator of the U.S. Agency for International Development, Ambassador Mark Green. He says U.S. efforts to boost world food production has included nearly $3 billion in agricultural loans and more than $800 million in private sector investments for farmers over the past 6 years. He was speaking with VOA's Peter Clotey. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiyis Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. And of course, please stay tuned to the sunny side of sports coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Kurt Bynum, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Hello, this is Peter Clotey, host of Nightline Africa. Please join us every Saturday and Sunday at 16 and 18 hours UTC. Nightline Africa is VOA's Africa's weekend show that provides news, features, and entertainment news about Africa and the world. Tune in. You will be glad you did. I guarantee it.
Celebrate the sounds of Africa today, yesterday, and tomorrow. That's our mission in your show, Music Time in Africa. Hello, I'm your host, Heather Maxwell. Join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC and discover the best Pan-African music in the world. We play it all right here. Only the best on VOA Africa.